Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. We have an extensive agenda today, members, and we're hoping the other members will arrive shortly. We're in a difficult position in terms of our scheduling. I guess I'll announce our schedule for the week once we have the rest of the members here to talk to. But because we have limited time today, we're going to get started. And Senator Rummel, we're going to start your bill since you are here and ready to go. And hopefully the other members will arrive shortly. Senate File 3249. So where's the Minnesota? Wasn't here. I'm sorry, I didn't see Senator Tomasoni. So we'll go ahead and let Senator Rummel do her bill quickly because she has to go to another committee, and then we'll take Senator Tomasoni. Go ahead, please, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we're going to be brief because we know you have a rough schedule. What we have before us is Senate File 3242. And this is a bill for an act relating to the environment, modifying some appropriations that we began last year. And I have with me Lisa Thorvig from the PCA, and I have also with me the city manager from White Bear Lake, Mark Sather. And they can probably speak to the bill more clearly and quickly than I can. So I would like to turn the mic over to Lisa Thorvig.
Senator Rummel, I'm looking through the bill. Just point to whatever your new language is
page
here.
Four.
The new language page is on four. Page four.
Bottom of page four.
The bottom of page four. Okay. And can you just tell us briefly? Well, if you want your witnesses to explain, that's fine.
Briefly, as I understand it, this is an appropriation, a direction of. It's not a new appropriation. It takes money that we appropriated last year and directs it toward a completion of a project. The project is described on page 3, section C.
Okay. So we'll hear more about that as we move forward. Great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Thorvig, Municipal Division Director at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And describing the change, we have a PCA fact sheet that I was going to quickly go through. The issue is coal tar-based sealant, which is widely used to seal driveways and parking lots, and it causes environmental issues. And in 2009, the legislature adopted both policy and funding to require the agency to do research on the coal tar-based sealants and to stop state agencies from using it, notify local units of government of the environmental concerns using it, and to do research to figure out how best to get it out of stormwater ponds, treat it, and properly dispose of it. The legislature appropriated $155,000 in fiscal year 2010 for the agency to start doing research on monitoring and trying to figure out treatment and best management practices to remove the coal tar from stormwater ponds and treat it or dispose of it. We have completed much of that. Much of the money went for that purpose. There is a very promising treatment alternative for these contaminated sediments using compost. And the University of Minnesota right now is in the process of completing some bench scale testing. They will produce a report in June, and if it's promising, we'll move to field testing of that alternative.
Ms. Thorvig, did you say using compost?
Yard waste compost.
Okay.
So in 2011, the legislature appropriated $345,000 for the purposes of providing local governments with grant money to address their coal tar problems in their stormwater ponds. One of the requirements to get the grant money is that the city adopts a coal tar ordinance banning the use of these coal tar sealants, and that makes them eligible for the grant money. So far, the grants are limited to $100,000 per year, and so far the only city that is pursuing a coal tar ordinance that we're aware of is the city of White Bear Lake. So the of the 345,000 appropriated, up to 145 would be directed to complete the coal tar research that PCA is undertaking. $200,000 would remain for grants to cities who complete the coal tar ordinance and then apply for the grant money. The grant is a 50% grant, so the city has to match it with $100,000 of their own money. And so the request is a rider change to direct up to $145,000 to complete the coal tar treatment research that the PCA started in 2010. The fact sheet describes the actions that have been completed to date, and then on the back of the fact sheet are the remaining needs, and the research needs are described in the last bullet on the fact sheet. So with that, I'll be happy to answer questions, or you could hear from White Bear Lake.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Thorvig. Are there questions? Okay. Sir?
Mr. Sather. Mark Sather.
Mr. Sather. Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, Mark Sather. I'm the city manager in White Bear Lake. I'd like to speak to two elements of this legislation or this particular problem. White Bear Lake, like most cities, particularly in the metropolitan area, are dealing with stormwater issues of increasing magnitude. And to comply with best practices as well as the law, we have stormwater settling ponds throughout our communities, and it's a practice that has been used for years, but we've become more aware of the need to maintain those ponds. One of the maintenance measures is to remove the bottom sediment that collects in them. Until recently, that was a whole project, although it was expensive, and particularly in residential areas. It's rather artful. You have to do it in the winter more often than not when you can bring in heavy equipment. In most cases, there's homes around a lot of these ponds, and it's difficult. But we've undertaken that, and we've been able to budget and set aside funds to do so. Excuse me. Recently, when we do routine tests of the sediment before the project begins, we have found that they it puts them at a level that no longer allows us to treat them as simple spoils and dispose of them as a measure or something of that nature. We now have to take a number of these ponds to special landfills. And just to give an example, we undertook a project this winter a pond that was not contaminated, and our cost per hauling every cubic yard of sediment that was excavated from that pond was about $27 a ton. We, in our queue, is another pond where we have found that the soil is contaminated, sediment is contaminated, it would have to be taken to a proper landfill. That cost, our estimate is it's going to be $54 a ton, twice as much as would otherwise have cost us. Cost for that particular pond is about $250,000. We tested that to see if, in fact, we were getting good competitive bids. We found that the city of Shoreview undertook a project this winter also, and their cost was $62 a ton. And so you can see that compared to 27, which came out of a competitive bid project, disposing of these contaminated soils is at least twice as much. Two hopes that we're trying to find is whether there's a method of treating these soils or disposing of them other than a landfill. The reason that cost, by the way, is so high is it costs us between $11 and $13 a cubic yard to dispose of it. More important is we have to truck it great distances to get it to a point where it can be. We're looking for alternative measures. We've heard from contractors. Disposing this or mixing this material with yard waste and breaking matter down through decomposition seems to be much better and hopefully a lot less expensive. Plus, as mentioned in the earlier testimony, we figured the first way to get out of a hole is to stop digging. So we do have an ordinance that's up for final reading before our city council in the next 30 days. It would prohibit the sale of these sealants within our community. You may find some messages from the front that might be helpful. There's two retail establishments within our town that sell this. Both of them have told us that they've already, because of growing concern, have taken the driveway sealants with pine or with coal tar off of the market. We've also found that some of the large home improvement centers, including Home Depot, have indicated that they have or will be doing that. So we've now concentrated our efforts on commercial applicators, the people who will come out to your yard and handle that yourselves. Most of them have told us that they have or are considering eliminating that. So with more prompting or education from the public sector, we might be able to eliminate that source. We're not testifying in any way that we believe that coal tar based sealants are the only source of the PAHs that find their way into our drainage ponds. We think it's a significant source and that it does have an alternative that is relatively painless for homeowners.
Very good. Thank you very much. Mr. Sather. So are there questions for Mr. Sather? Let me ask, would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 3249? Okay. And Mr. Sather, I assume you support the bill.
Yes.
Very good.
Madam Chair, many of the suburbs have used these stormwater ponds. They were developed in the 70s and 80s when development went into the suburban area. It's no longer a common practice, but we have a lot of suburban areas that have them and will be dealing with this problem. And so to find a solution is larger than just one stormwater pond here or there. It's all around the suburban area where they have to dredge these ponds because their point is to collect the runoff. So if we can find a solution from the university in this experiment that's going on in White Bear, it should ease the cost to those particular communities.
Yeah, it would be nice to find a solution of at least a part of the problem. I know in St. Paul, the ball field that was just found to be contaminated, where my son played Little League last summer, they found PAHs, among other things, like lead. And I think they said it used to be a dump. So it was never a stormwater pond, as far as I know, but nobody really knows what all was put there. So there's probably multiple sources and multiple locations where we have a problem we have to figure out. Senator Vickerman.
Well, Madam Chair, first I apologize for being late. I had to meet with the veterans, but I'm just curious, on page 3 of the bill, what does that do? Does that do for $1 million ethanol plans? Do you know exactly what that...
Oh, Senator Vickerman, this is all old language. This is all from last year. So the only new language is on the bottom of page 4, and it takes the money that we already approved last year for coal tar work and allocates some of it for research that at the request of the PCA and Senator Rummel's bill and White Bear Lake. So that clarification... Thank you for asking. All right, we do have a quorum present, members, and Senator Rummel, would you like to move your bill? I think this would be, we can put this in the omnibus bill, or if you'd like, that would be fine. All right, Senator Rummel moves that Senate File 3249 be recommended to pass and laid on the table for inclusion in our omnibus bill. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Senator Rummel. Members, while we have a number of you at the table, I want to just mention our schedule briefly before we start Senator Tomasoni's bill. As you all know, we've had some scheduling issues this week, and I've been very frustrated because we have a lot of work to accomplish. Our deadline for our second omnibus bill, our non-general fund bill, is Monday. My deadline is Friday. And so we've had to really hustle to find time to meet and, you know, coordinate with Senator Vickerman's division and others who are in the same bind as ours. So our schedule for this week is we're going to meet today till we finish our agenda, hopefully 12:30. Session doesn't start till 12:30. We have about 20 bills left we need to hear this week that members have that they want to be considered for our omnibus bill. So we will also be meeting tomorrow morning, Wednesday morning, 10 o'clock. I lost my cheat sheet. Wednesday morning in room 123, about 10 to 12 again, or 12:30. And then Wednesday night, tomorrow night, please be here, 6 o'clock in room 107. And then we should be able to finish all our bills, and then we need to meet Friday morning to mark up the bill and to put an omnibus bill out. And we'll try to get you that as soon as we're able to put something together and hopefully give people advance warning. We'll do it as quickly as we can. So I do need you here Friday morning as well, and I don't think it will take all that long to finish it. But we need to wrap it up and get it to Senator Cohen so that it can be processed hopefully on Monday before the break. Any questions on that? Thank you for your patience with multiple conflicts. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and you may have already gone over this, but so Senate File 1657, unfortunately, Senator Olson is...
She had a family emergency.
I'm wondering if we could, since we're going to be meeting, if it would be more fair to her if we could meet have that heard on...
We did give her the option of waiting to delay that till she came back, till Wednesday, till tomorrow. But I think she asked Senator Chaudhry to present it, and I think she's comfortable with that. Is that true?
Madam Chair, yes. I talked to Senator Mary Olson's staff, and that's what they told us.
So we'd be, you know, it's fine. We offered
it's
her
fine.
The choice,
yeah,
so
just
whatever.
Yeah.
Just so we can keep things moving forward. And she would like to have that be included in our omnibus bill. So thank you for asking. All right, we'll take up Senator Tomasoni's bill next. Senate File 2676. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate File 2676, Madam Chair and committee members, is a bill establishing a rebate program for the manufacture and use of solar panels or photovoltaics. The idea here is to create some green manufacturing jobs, but not only create the jobs, but to also encourage the use of solar panels and solar voltaics in private homes through the use of rebate programs. This has been successful in other states, and the best thing to do here, Madam Chair, is to just turn this over to my witnesses and let them explain how it would function, how it would work. We made a couple of adjustments to the bill. I'm sure you have those in front of you in the first committee that we were at, and I think we can go forward explaining the bill with my witnesses, Madam Chair.
That's great. Senator Tomasoni, Mr. Cirkvenic, are you first, or Mr. Carroll?
Mr. Carroll. Senator Anderson, the last time we spoke, you mentioned you would like us to put a 10-minute PowerPoint presentation together. I know we're constrained for time, but I will hustle through that as quickly as possible.
Very good.
Okay.
This is an important issue, and we want to really get the details.
Okay. First of all, this is just the general objectives of the program is to create long-term manufacturing in the state of Minnesota and really to jumpstart what I would say is the consumer and commercial solar PV installations in Minnesota. You know, based on our information, looking at the existing rebates here, there's about a 19-year payback for a consumer for a solar investment in the state of Minnesota, which is the primary reason why you know, you've had installed capacity of less than a little bit more than a megawatt. This was through April of last year. I'm assuming it's a little bit more now. But given that almost 9,000 megawatts has been installed in the United States, there's a huge opportunity for growth here. Your solar resource is very good. Your insulation factors are better than Germany, which is the number one country in the world for solar installation. And it's comparable to other areas that are very sunny, including Houston, Texas. Obviously, the U.S. is in recession, and really what we're here to talk about are state incentives to promote solar. The solar industry really is in the early stages of development. It's immature. There is a lot of ramp-up in solar cell capacity going on, primarily in China. To basically support strong European demand, which I think ultimately is going to fall off. And the hope is, and I've done quite a bit of research on this since our last discussion, that over the next 5 to 7 years, that solar actually will become comparable to, grid price parity. Now, Deutsche Bank Securities came out with an analysis of that. Their definition of grid price parity was about 15 cents a kilowatt hour, which is about twice what you pay here in the state of Minnesota now. If you project what they think will happen technologically out over 10 or 12 years, they feel that it'll get pretty close to that level. And so I guess the main point that I'd like to make is that, as with any new technology, it needs support in order to get started. And the goal here is to create an industry here in the state of Minnesota. Just for some comparative purposes, our plant is currently in the state of Washington. And if you look at the top, the solar resource obviously here in Minnesota is significantly better than what it is in Washington. Washington has cost of electricities, which a little bit cheaper than here, but very comparable, very cheap compared to the rest of the country. And then you can see the incentives. We've transferred this to a dollar per watt basis, but Washington incentive is basically a feed-in tariff, 54 cents a kilowatt hour, but it really equates to $5 a watt installed. The $2.25 a watt is currently what Xcel Energy, their rebate program is. Net metering in Minnesota, you've got a 40 kilowatt cap. In Washington, it's 100 kilowatt, and the return on investment speaks for itself. Our proposed Minnesota legislation is basically a rebate would be net of existing state and utility rebates up to $5 a watt. Based on our projections, just looking at Xcel's territory and the amount of commitment that they've made, over the next 5 years, we'll be looking to do at least 2,500 homes, possibly more. I've provided you a Minnesota residential example. This is a 5-kilowatt size, which is a little bit larger than what your average size is going to be. At an $8 a watt installed cost, this would equate to $40,000. These are the various assumptions that I've made. Basically, the payment would come from several different areas, primarily the federal investment tax credit, which is $2.40 a watt. 30% of your cost would be there. The very important point here is that state rebates are taxable for federal purposes. So even though Xcel Energy's $2.25 a watt is being given to the consumer has to pay taxes on that. His net benefit is only $1.46 a watt.
Can I just interrupt for a second, Mr.
Yes.
Carroll? What tax do you pay on it? You pay income tax?
Federal income tax,
okay.
Yes.
All right.
I would also note that the 35% federal tax level is probably going to go up. President Obama said that they're going to raise it to 39. So it'll be even less than what we're proposing here. This rebate for the proposed manufacturer rebate, I just basically topped this up to $2.75, so you can see the benefit of $5 a watt. And then the following page, just to give you an idea from a pie chart, is, you know, where's the money coming from to install it? Basically, 30% of it is coming from the homeowner. 40% is coming from the state rebates, both the Xcel rebate and the subject rebate that we're here to talk about today. The other 30% would come from the federal investment tax credit. This is a fairly detailed 5-kilowatt residential example. You can see the capital contribution of $40,000 up front, tax credit, your cash savings. Another point I'd like to make is we tried to structure this bill so that the rebate takes place over a 5-year period of time. This better utilizes some of the depreciation benefits that are given to a solar consumer. If you pay all this money up front, you're going to wind up with a big tax bill. This is a better way to shelter your income by giving the rebate out over a longer period of time. Finally, just our own product is a polycrystalline panel. It's very robust. It would work beautifully up here in the state of Minnesota. Here's some photographs of it. This is our manufacturing plant up in Arlington, Washington, which is up and running. You know, basically, we are assuming this bill gets passed and we can see that there are incentives being made here, a commitment made in, by the state of Minnesota, our company is willing to basically invest here and start up a solar PV module line. It would be capable of producing between 10 and 12 megawatts per year. This would be operating full-time, 24 hours a day. Of course, we would start out with one shift, probably doing 4 to 5 megawatts. But that would be 17 to 22 full-time employees. And we're looking to do this up in the Mountain Iron Renewable Energy Industry Park.
Mr. Carroll.
Yes.
I'm just trying to do the math here. I'm going back to that 10 megawatts a year that you thought you would produce.
That would be the capacity.
That would be the capacity of our plant.
Yeah.
Not in the ramp up.
If we were to operate three shifts, 24 hours a day, the plant would be capable of producing 10 megawatts.
And how many people would that employ?
Three
shifts, 24.
We would start out with 17, probably about 30. That would be 24 hours a day.
Okay. And then, so I'm just going back to your 5-kilowatt example.
Yep.
That would be, what, times 10, 2,000 systems like that? Am I doing my math right?
2,500 over a five-year period.
2,500 that you could produce over a five-year period.
That's right.
And those are fairly large systems for a residential.
That's right. I actually think in your state, according to Lynn Hinkle, I think your average size here is smaller than 5 kilowatts. It's actually 3.5. It's a little bit smaller.
Oh, that's the average? I see some nodding heads. Okay. Good to know. All right. Do you want to finish, Mr. Cirkvenic, and then take questions? Or unless there's a question right now, Senator, go ahead, Mr. Cirkvenic.
Madam Chair, Gary Cirkvenic from the Mountain Iron Economic Development Authority. And the last slide is one that I'm going to discuss. It's basically where does the money come from for the project, and we're tapping the Xcel Energy RDF fund. Currently, there's about $19 million going into that fund. As you know, in 2013, the state fiscal year, it will go up an additional $3.5 million or so because of increased cast storage. So our original proposal, I think, was rich for the size that's available in the fund. So we've scaled that back, and I believe Senator Tomasoni has no, at some point.
Okay.
And the scale back level is $2 million in fiscal year 2011, $4 million in 12, and $5 million in 13, 14 and 15. It basically reduces, from our best guess, the fourth grant cycle from $15 million to $9 million, and takes advantage of increased revenues in the out years.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair,
Senator Tomasoni,
would you like to put the amendment
sure.
on that just
Let's take
makes
a look
it consistent
at it.
With that? And just for the
thank you.
Committee's benefit, the idea with the rebate program is that it makes it affordable for people to do it. And without the program, you're looking at a 19 or 20-year payback, and people don't oftentimes think that that's a good deal. But with this particular rebate in place, it'll make it a 5 or 6-year payback. And so we believe that that'll actually incentivize people to want to do the solar panels on their homes. But, Madam Chair, the A5 amendment is one that would put the bill in the shape that the slide actually depicts here.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Ms. Doyle?
Madam Chair, members, there is a typo on line 1.8. That $5,000 should be $5 million.
Oh.
Little typo.
Add 3 zeros. So this amendment, basically your original bill would proposed $5 million a year for
5 years.
5 years. And you're changing it to a ramp up starting at $2 million in 2011, then $4 million, then $5 million for the remaining 3 years. Okay.
Correct.
And it's the same. It's repeated twice. I haven't engrossed this yet, but it's.
One's the transfer and one's the appropriation.
Got it. Thank you. One is the transfer and one is the actual appropriation.
And Madam Chair, I should also point out to the committee that this is only available in the XL service area. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Does everyone understand the A5 amendment? I think that's helpful to reduce the cost for us to consider. So I think that we should adopt this. Would someone like
Madam
to move?
Madam Chair, I'll move the amendment, A5 amendment.
Senator Kubley moves the A5 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Carroll, how long would it take you to build your plant and start manufacturing lines?
If this is a go, I think by this time next year, we'd be manufacturing. We'd probably be taking orders a little bit earlier than that to try to fill up the pipeline.
Okay. So by 2011, there would be a market going for
That's
these.
That's correct.
So, okay.
And remember, you have an existing solar manufacturer here who would be taking advantage of it, I'm sure.
That's right. And they're already producing 10K solar.
Mm-hmm.
We have to take a close look, members, at the Renewable Development Fund and the spreadsheet. Why don't we pass that out? You know, what's available when and what is the best way to utilize those funds for those. And what we have remaining, I mean, the stimulus dollars, we put some money into the solar rebate, and that money is still there. So maybe we can get an update on how much is still available. Those are statewide rebates that are available. But this would sort of piggyback on that because that money, that was one-time money that will not be around forever, and previous rebates have gone very quickly. So I guess we'll have to consider those things. Mr. Mueller, do you want to talk about this?
Madam Chair and members, this is the chart or spreadsheet that was handed out earlier this session. That was brought to us by Xcel Energy, and this coincides with our fiscal years. And basically, Xcel was proposing to do a $15 million RFP for a new cycle of grants in fiscal year 11. And if they did that $15 million, you can see on the bottom line, there would be no balance left. So if we did this proposal in Senate File 2676, it would basically be reducing the amount of money that Xcel has available for making their own grants. And with the amendment at $2 million, that's doable, but it cuts into the amount that Xcel is able to offer for their own grant program. So, yes, there is money available in the RDF fund, but it depends on who's gets to it first is sort of the way it works.
Okay. Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Tomasoni and your witnesses. I apologize for getting here a little bit late, and maybe you already covered this, but the question I have is, are the private capital markets unwilling to capitalize your project? Is that the problem that is why we're here looking for the state to fulfill that need? Is there a reason why the private capital markets will not fund this venture?
Mr. Carroll.
Yeah. Senator, absent these subsidies, a bank or a financial institution I think would be unwilling to extend somebody a 19-year loan, basically collateralized by a PV installation. The problem is the payback period is just way too long, and I don't know any financial institution that'd be willing to go out that length of time. The point of this program is to get it to a point where a bank will consider financing it. That's why we've done a 5-year rebate program here, so that a banker not only will look at the cost savings that somebody is getting from selling electricity or not buying electricity, but also the cash flow from the rebate to basically finance the installation of his PV system.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Hamm.
And is there a reason why the banks would not be willing to take the risk and do this on the terms that you've specified? What's the rationale for that? I think you're right, but is there a particular reason why they wouldn't do that?
I don't know any bank that's, excuse me, Senator Hand, I'm unaware of any bank that's willing to make a 19-year loan collateralized by PV equipment these days. It just, I don't think that exists.
Well, and Madam Chair, and I guess that's part of my reluctance. If banks are unwilling to do it, the people of Minnesota should be willing to do it because it's a better risk. Or, I mean, part of the, as I understand this, part of the reluctance of banks would be it's a high-risk deal that has a possibility of not seeing economic vitality, but the state of Minnesota and the people of Minnesota should take that risk. I'm struggling with how that makes sense. If it can't be made sense of in the private economic markets, why would it make sense for us as a state to do it?
Mr. Cirkvenik.
Madam Chair, Senator Hamm, I think the issue is the money in the fund has been set up by legislative act with the mission to increase penetration of renewable energy in the Minnesota marketplace. So that's the mission of the fund, and the program's designed to meet that mission. And so you're taking money from XL ratepayers that are going into a current fund that gives out grants, and the legislature is now directing rebate program back to those ratepayers. So the money doesn't go to a manufacturer. The money goes directly to a ratepayer. It's, in effect, an enhanced tax credit. One could look.
Senator Hand, remember that over the last several years, we have, as a state, provided solar rebates to Minnesota consumers because there's a lot of interest among the public in installing solar, and we also have state goals that require us to move to more renewable energy, and so that's been a way to achieve both of those goals. I think you might have missed the testimony at the beginning that Mr. Carroll gave that I think you would be really interested in that talks about the solar industry and the trajectory that it's on is that it expects to be selling systems that are competitive with other conventional electricity sources within 7 years, maybe not at Minnesota prices, and Minnesota prices maybe a few years beyond that. And so what we are in right now is a transition period, and the solar industry is growing rapidly. And we have an opportunity. I mean, what I really like about this bill is that I've supported strongly solar rebates over many years, and they provided those opportunities for Minnesota to invest in solar and to make it affordable for the average homeowner to do it, or not sort of affordable for those really motivated homeowners who want to put some money up out there. But with these additional incentives available, it makes it possible. But this bill says not only are we going to do what we've been doing for years, and it's been incredibly supported by the public, but we're going to get a manufacturing plant to boot. We're going to get jobs here in Minnesota creating these instead of importing these solar panels from China, which is where most of the market is going right now. And so it provides really another win to that win-win situation. And by the time unlike some other energy sources, this promises that in, 5 to 10 years, they will not be coming and asking for incentives anymore. We will not need them. But right now, we need them. There's some other electricity sources that I could mention that have never made that claim and never will. And so we don't want to get into a debate about some other things. But this is something that I think will pay off for Minnesotans. Senator Hand?
Oh, Madam Chair, I appreciate that. And I know we've done this in the state of Minnesota for some time, and this is not – the idea of solar panels is not new technology. It's been around for at least a couple of decades and probably longer than that. And I think the fact of the matter is that none of these things would be done without dramatic subsidies. Technologies exist, but they exist at very high cost. And the fact that we can offer public money to make this more attractive to consumers is certainly an incentive, but – that's a huge risk that we're taking. I don't see that it's one, especially at this particular time, that we ought to put the people of the state of Minnesota, taxpayers, in the position of being taking a high-risk flyer on a deal that I think has very little chance of ever being economical. And so I'm just reluctant to do it. But.
I saw Senator Chaudhry, then Senator Kubley.
Yes, Madam Chair, and whoever can answer it. I had a question on the maybe the process or the science of it. On one of your slides, you've got, it talks about degradation equal to 0.5% per year Mm-hmm. What does that mean, and what does that refer to, and what does it mean for the energy output in out years, presumably when the payoff has occurred?
Mr. Carroll.
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, degradation is something that occurs with solar panels over time. 0.5% per year actually is a fairly conservative number. I think it's actually going to be considerably less than this. New technology shows that degradation on solar panels that have been in operation for 25 years has been about 80%. So in other words, 25 years from now, it'll be operating at 80% of its capacity. So that's just something that happens with solar panels over time. There's new technology that's addressing that, and you know, unlike other forms of renewable energy, solar PV, I think, really offers an opportunity over time to really decrease its price and technologically become much more efficient than what we see now. And so, anyway, that's some of the promise that the future holds for PV.
And that, Mr. Carroll, did you mention that there's a depreciation tax write-off that accompanies that or that reflects that? Or is that maybe it's not connected to the
From a financial standpoint, no, it's not
okay.
connected.
All right. Senator Chaudhry?
Follow-up. Is there there new technology coming just around the corner as well? Is it? And I thought I heard that it was silicon-based. I'm not really familiar with it, but other than photovoltaic.
I'm not an expert from a technology standpoint, but there are all sorts of competing technologies that are coming. That's why I say that the industry is really in its early stages. There's a long way to go.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I, you know, just what you said there, you know, I've forgotten your name already, but.
Mr. Carroll.
Mr. Carroll, yeah. You know, are you using the thin film technology or?
No, sir. This would be the standard polycrystalline cell. This would be the old style technology.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And, Madam Chair, I guess I intended just to, you know, address Senator Hand's concern. You know, there really are no non-subsidized forms of energy out there, Senator Hahn.
That's not true.
Oh, it is very true. I think, you know, start looking at, you know, some of the pieces that are out there. You know, nuclear energy is subsidized. They can't even find their own insurance. You and I buy it for them.
It's called the public option.
You know,
the public option for nuclear power. They got it.
It's not an option. It's
we're going
mandate.
Down the wrong
just,
road here.
It just seems to me that when you start looking at the energy industry, you know, if you can find a non-subsidized form, I guess I'd encourage you to take it. But I don't think you're going to be able to do that. You know, I've dug into that with some, vigor. And I honestly don't think there are any non-subsidized forms out there. And certainly the renewables are even though they are subsidized, I think that subsidy comes in significantly lower than some of the traditional forms. So, you know, but like Senator Anderson, I'm not sure we need to get into that debate here. But, you know, I think I'd just offer that for your consideration.
Well, and Madam
Senator
Chair,
Mann.
Thank you. And thank you, Senator Kubley. I do disagree with you. I guess it depends on what the meaning of the word subsidy is, I suppose. But the fact of the matter is that the so-called renewable energy products or methods to do that have been around a long, long time. And they've been used for a long, long time. And they are not economical. And that is a clear, established fact. The only way they're economical is when you take large amounts of tax dollars and buy down the cost. That's not true with coal. That's not true with nuclear. That's not true with oil. There are things that we have done and legislatively to make costs higher for things like nuclear energy. I agree with that. We've put in place regimens that drive costs up. But the point is that these are not new technologies. They are not economical, and we are putting the public at risk to do things, and it's a form of corporate welfare, frankly. It's a boondoggle. We're offering people to come in and say, here, take some public money, do something. do it for however long, and we're not going to be looking at a payback. We're not acting as a venture capitalist firm. We're not putting our money at risk. We're putting the public money at risk. I think these are bad ideas, and we shouldn't do them, but we will. I know. So go ahead.
Senator Hahn, I think it's well established that if you added up all the federal and state incentives and subsidies for other forms of energy, that they have dwarfed renewable energy subsidies for decades. Well, I can provide you documentation, and I'm sure Senator Kubley could too. Let's remember that these are ratepayer dollars. They're not taxpayer dollars, and that this represents a voluntary incentive for those who are interested in taking advantage of it. And so just wanted to put that out there. All right. Do we have other questions for our witnesses? I know there's a couple of other people that perhaps would like to be heard on this bill. When you presented your kind of your breakdown of cost for an installation, you included those other pieces, but I'm not sure if that's reflected in the bill, the other incentives that are available. And we want to make sure that we don't have, that we don't have a rebate that would be, that's, you know, we want to make sure that we include the offsets from other incentives in what's available to those taking advantage of this rebate so that they don't end up making money on the deal that they don't need to make. Mr. Cirkvenik.
Madam Chair, I believe that's addressed in 2.18 under B. To be eligible for rebate under this section, the applicant must present evidence to the Commissioner of Commerce that the applicant has applied for rebate or other form of financial assistance available exclusively to the owners of the property from the utility or the state.
So they have to apply for those, but in terms of the amount of rebate that they receive, there's no, I think we'll need to maybe establish what that amount is specifically based on what other incentives are available so that it adds up to 100% and so that the homeowner does contribute something. Now, I think if I'm reading this correctly, you just have a sort of a lump sum that would be available. And would it be up to Commerce then to decide how much would go to each person, each installation?
Madam Chair, I believe how the bill suggests Commerce deals with the issue is that to be eligible for the enhanced rebate program that's before you, the individual consumer must purchase it from a Minnesota manufacturer. Okay? Number two, you must apply for the state rebate that's currently in existence or the rebate offered by a utility. Because this is only applies to the XL service district, service territory, you must apply for the XL rebate. I believe the XL rebate program is capped at $4.6 million per year for the next 3 years. And so a consumer would have to apply for that and the state rebate. For example, the state has a limited amount of money in their rebate program, which is usually oversubscribed by a certain point. If a consumer gets the state rebate and the XL rebate, it's $5 net. So it's a smaller rebate from this enhanced program. If the state program is maxed out, this rebate then adjusts upward to $5. So there is a cap, exactly like you are suggesting in the bill, at $5 per watt.
Okay. I see that now. And I think the only thing that's missing, perhaps, is the federal incentives aren't named here, and maybe we should specifically include those. Or maybe I'm missing something. Mr. Cirkvenik, it says that, they have to, you have to apply, you have to present evidence, back to where you were quoting from, that you've applied for a rebate from the utility and from the state, but it doesn't mention federal tax incentives.
Madam Chair, one of the reasons we didn't include that is because it's a tax issue, not a rebate issue. So there's no application. It's after the fact.
But if they're getting that tax credit, shouldn't that be factored into their $5 a watt cost?
And, Madam Chair, I think we do in the analysis that they still are paying net about a 30% or a third of the total installed cost. John, do you have any?
Yeah, the $5 a watt basically on an after-tax basis covers about 40% of the cost of a PV installed system at $8 a watt. And so the federal investment tax credit would be an additional 30% on top of that. If you dropped it down, I mean, you know, your payback periods probably be 10 or 12 years, so you probably wouldn't get there.
All right, we'll have to think that one over.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Tomasoni, do you have your hand up?
No, I'm just holding my pen in
here. You're just holding your pen up. All right. Let's see. I know Mr. Grant wanted to testify, and I don't know if Bill Glunn would like to, and others in the industry, we'd be welcome other testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League, and I have been and continue to be a member of the board of the Renewable Development Fund. I was one of the charter members of the board. I want to make clear, though, that I'm not speaking on behalf of the board. The board has not taken a position on this bill. My concern, Madam Chair, is not with the intent of the legislation. Obviously, we support solar energy and moving ahead with getting more solar energy installed in Minnesota. My concern is with the source of the dollars. And I know that you had testimony from Excel in your committee over the last couple of weeks. And I guess I'm going to have to get with Mr. Cirkvenic because I'm not seeing how the math works on this and whether or not there really is the money in the fund, particularly in the out years, since the chart that's been distributed only runs through fiscal year 2013, and I think we need to look beyond that at what happens in the last 3 years of the incentive program. One thing to make the committee aware of is that when the Renewable Development Fund Board goes out with a grant solicitation, we do so with a request for proposals and receive multiple proposals to evaluate and do so then in a very rigorous fashion, comparing costs and benefits of a wide variety of programs and types, including solar energy, which has been much more prominently featured in recent rounds of grants, including, for example, a grant to the City of Minneapolis for solar on the Convention Center, which will be a 2-megawatt project, one of the largest built certainly in the United States. So I guess what I'm suggesting is that whereas in this approach we're kind of picking an outcome and deciding that this is the right way to incentivize residential solar through the, if a proposal like this were to come to the Renewable Development Fund Board, it would be considered along with other similar types of incentive mechanisms. But I think it would give us the opportunity to really weigh the benefits of one approach over another. In this instance, Madam Chair, you're being asked to pick the winner. And I'm not suggesting that it's not a good approach. I'm just suggesting that it hasn't been through the crucible of a competitive solicitation process, which I think has really benefited the work that the Renewable Development Fund has done to date. So at least at this point, Madam Chair, I'd like to suggest that I have concerns about whether or not sufficient dollars remain in the fund for this type of an effort, and further suggest that even if there is, it clearly supplants the decision-making approach that I've just relayed to you, which I think is a superior approach to deciding how to move forward with incentive programs of this nature.
All right.
Happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Appreciate your comments. Are there any questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Who else would like to testify? Please come forward. Okay, Director Glunn from the Office of Energy Security. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, I heard my name called, and so did you have specific questions, or?
Just want to know if you have any opinions or thoughts to share with us on this. You don't have to testify.
Madam Chair, Sanders, I did share the language. I don't think I have a copy of the amendment, so I shared the original language from the bill with my staff and asked them to comment. And they brought a number of concerns to my attention. One, just to echo what Mr. Grant said, that just looking at the math on the spreadsheet, it's not obvious that there are those funds available with apparently the fund going negative at some point in the near future. So I was concerned whether there are those funds available through the program, the RDF program, that is. And then we have a little bit of a concern that we've seen, and I can share that some of the stimulus funds that we've gone through our office as an example, that when word gets out that the rebates are coming, and that tends to actually have the opposite effect, that grinds activity in a sector to a halt as people wait for the possibility of rebates being available. So having a program with fairly generous rebate levels, we would be concerned that folks who are considering a solar installation might decide to postpone that until these rebates are available and wait on that. And it would actually retard growth in the sector for a period of time until a manufacturer who qualified could be up and running, or the rebate program could be set up and be running. And the size of the grants, what we've been doing is toying with the idea that perhaps we should have grants as a percentage of the cost rather than a fixed dollar amount. We heard the testimony, the absolute cost is expected to fall over time, and so by having a fixed incentive, it would become ever more generous as the overall costs fall, and we would think at some point, if not in the very beginning, it would end up providing more incentive than is strictly needed to provide an incentive for the behavior we're trying to induce. So perhaps a sliding scale rebate tied to the total installed cost might be a better approach, a more efficient approach in trying to get the in favor. And I'm not sure, notwithstanding the testimony about helping some folks tax shelters, the installment payments are a complicating factor. Rather than the one and done rebate, you're going to pay it out over 5 years. It might help somebody's tax situation, but again, I'm not sure that's the direction we're going to go in. And Madam Chair, but just because I can't help myself, I got to bring up the subsidy issue again that Senator Hahn brought up. If it is certainly true, Senator Kubley, that if you look over time at the billions and billions of dollars that have been put into nuclear power, some of these others, they are huge dollar amounts. Huge dollar amounts have come from federal taxpayers or whomever to subsidize these different industries. But when you look at it on a per kilowatt hour basis, and compare to the per kilowatt hour incentives that have been provided to renewable power, it is certainly true that on a per unit of energy actually produced basis, subsidies for renewable energy dwarf those for conventional energy. You look at the absolute dollars, they look huge, because there just haven't been many solar kilowatt hours produced in the history of the industry compared to a massive industry like nuclear power or coal power. So I know people talk about subsidies and we're trying to compare numbers, but I really think the appropriate comparison is a per unit energy produced basis, and rather than just looking at absolute dollars, because then I don't think you're getting the apples to apples comparison. But that's my soapbox for Tuesday morning on March 3rd.
Well, Mr. Glahn, I guess I would I think that's an interesting point you make about the subsidies. I guess I would suggest that the renewable energies haven't necessarily – the wind industry is different now because it's grown so rapidly and matured so much. But they haven't been able to reach those economies of scale that industries like nuclear have because of the support they've gotten for decades. And I think what we're seeing with solar is that it's right on the verge of reaching those economies of scale, which is why we're going to see the price go down dramatically. I don't think nuclear – I think nuclear has reached a point and it's not going further down in price. It's actually looking for bigger subsidies as time goes forward. So I think that's the only difference I would point out. Mr. Glenn.
Madam Chair, I hope you're right. I hope you're correct that we are on the cusp of this great renewable energy renaissance. But I think the point Senator Hand was trying to make was we've been on the cusp for 20, 30 years now, and we just seem to be, it just seems to be beyond the horizon, which we never reach.
But I think if we had invested at the same rate 20 years ago, maybe we would be in a different place. And so we're kind of doing now what we did for the nuclear industry in the 70s, perhaps. But anyway, well, I hope we're right, too. No one knows for sure. Mr. Glenn, can I? Oh, I'm sorry. I guess we're going to debate that. I'll have to call on members. Senator Saxog was first.
Well, I just have a real short couple of sentences here when we're talking about energy, and that's oil. That's the thing that's as soon as we start developing our non-renewables, all of a sudden the price of oil goes down and we all forget about it. And of course, that has everything to do with everything. So if we run out of oil, things will all of a sudden look very, very good, I think. So,
Senator Kubley.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I don't know. You know, I guess it probably would be good to look at a kilowatt per kilowatt, comparison, as Mr. Glenn mentions. But, I mean, we've dumped billions into the nuclear industry to build a high-level waste facility that has generated absolutely nothing. Talk about poking money down a rat hole. You know, it just seems to me that we've done it with nuclear in ways that we have never been willing to do with any other form of energy, and we still don't have anything to show for it. And what we do have to show for it is, all of the waste that we generate, we're going to have to sit on. You know, if you're going to generate nuclear power, you better get used to living with the waste. I think that's the message that we've gotten from the failure of Yucca Mountain. You know, for those of us that have been to Yucca Mountain, you know, it seems that even though there are some drawbacks to it, I don't think we're going to be able to find a better facility. And yet, when you look at Nevada's legislature, we were told by Nevada's attorney general that, there were only a few people in the Nevada legislature in the Senate who actually supported the construction of Yucca Mountain, and they all lost their seat in that year's election. You know, and there were none in the other House. So I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me there are a lot of questions that still surround other forms of energy that we're just not willing to look at those as being a portion of the subsidy that they gain.
Senator Kubley, thank you. And I think I'm as guilty as anyone, but I'm going to propose we only talk about solar energy for the rest of this committee hearing, because otherwise we'll never get to the other bills we have on the agenda. So,
in fact, Madam Chair, I think you could probably put some solar panels on top of Yucca Mountain if you wanted to.
Senator Tomasoni, that's the last comment on nuclear power, I think, that we need today. Thank you for that helpful suggestion to try to bring everyone together.
Blame their governor instead. She'd be
Mr. Glenn, let me just ask about, I think you made a very good point about the sort of the stops and starts of our subsidies, and I know we heard some real concerns in the industry last fall as we were waiting for the current rebate to get up and running. And I think that's a really valid point. We need to think about how to sort of provide some continuity. And I do think that having the benefit of having a longer-term program might, once it gets up and running, that would be a good thing to have something that wouldn't stop and start for those reasons that you mentioned. Does that make sense, that if we had a longer-term plan, it could maybe help? It's just building up to it that might be a problem.
Madam Chair, I think it would. But again, subject to my earlier caveat about having the sliding scale incentive that, you know, you have a five-year program, and I'm just making up numbers here. Say you have a five-year or 10-year program, so people know it's going to be around for a while. And you set it at $5, or $5 a watt, and then at the end of that period, you know, the market price is $4 a watt, we all hope. And then, you know, you end up with the golf cart example from the stimulus money. You're paying people to buy equipment. So, you know, I thought that the approach where you set it at a fraction of the cost where you think you might induce behavior, that breaking point where somebody says, okay, now it's worth it to me to go ahead and do it, is a better. But then again, if we learn any lesson from this session, that you have funds that flow through the government, and then they're always vulnerable to reappropriation. I don't know if that's a word. Maybe I just made that up as we go along. So I hear what you're saying, and in theory it works. I'm a little concerned about how the practice would unfold over time.
Thank you very much. All right, who else would like to speak? Come on up, please. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Rebecca Lundberg. I'm a NABCEP certified solar installer locally, a business owner. I serve on the executive chair for the Minnesota Renewable Energy Society, but currently here I am representing myself as a business owner. I would like to just give a few comments on this bill as proposed. We're very excited about backing for solar in Minnesota and feel that it has some really good potential. There are some lessons that we on the ground learned from the previous rebate program that I thought might be helpful as you're considering the language of this bill. First off, there's a lot of enthusiasm for solar power in Minnesota. We do have very good potential here, and homeowners really want to be part of that excitement, not just a few large grant projects that are funded, but homeowners appreciate being able to participate. The idea that investing now will help in the future is very well taken, and we feel strongly that that's why Germany and Spain, for example, have made such progress, that it was a political will and some support at the front end, and now it can stand on its own. Solar as a distributed energy source is a little bit different from some other energy sources that are really large scale, and in the long term is beneficial because of it. But in the short term, there's a lot of policy and hoops that have to be set in place in order to make all of those little systems integrate with our current grid. And also a lot of different authorities having jurisdiction that need education in how it works. And all of that is time consuming and cost intensive. And so that's what this sort of program can help fund on the front end. The previous funds that were allocated to state rebate through the Office of Energy Security only began to be released on the ground level 2 weeks ago. They were allocated months and months ago, but there are a lot of things that had to happen in place to get them actually released, and that is what causes really a problem for us on the industry level, because those stimulus funds ended up killing some solar businesses. Because there's a lot of media attention that the rebates are coming, as Mr. Glahn said, and then people wait, of course, until those funds have been released to start their project. And we aren't allowed to do any projects until they've been released. And so from September until 2 weeks ago, we've been waiting for the stimulus funds. So we would prefer that any funds that are allocated be allocated in such a way so that they're unencumbered as possible, so that when they're allocated, they can very shortly be released and not cause that holdup in the industry. So the fewer strings that are attached to them, so they can get out to the homeowner, the better. Otherwise, it causes the stimulus funds put people out of business, and that's exactly the opposite of the intent. I heard a comment about the local solar manufacturer was already producing, and that's true, and I've toured the facility, and we're very hopeful about a local manufacturer and encouraged to support local manufacturing. At the same time, while we were there for the training, we recognized that there are some very basic things about the product that aren't yet ready, things like grounding and UL listing. And we've learned from previous programs that some of those things are out of our control. How much backlog those testing facilities have could take months or years to get through. And so if we link stimulus or rebate funds to a specific thing, a winner, as has been mentioned, then we have to wait until all those things out of our control have been accomplished before we can actually release them, and that's bad for the industry. So I recognize that this program has other reasons. This Senate files 2676 has other really good reasons for being. For example, that it's going to support a local manufacturer, and I would like to suggest that perhaps an incentive could be given to the manufacturer directly instead of disrupting the market while we wait for the program, while we wait for them to set up, or while we wait for another manufacturer who's not yet ready to be in place. But if we put it in the language, then we have to wait for it. So perhaps we have limited funds already, as has been mentioned, from the RDF fund, but I would like to see them appropriated, first of all, when they're appropriated to solar rebates, to be a more general benefit, not just to Xcel customers, for example, if it's possible, because Xcel Energy is currently the only rebate. Minnesota Power and Xcel Energy are the only utilities that currently have a rebate. Our state funds will be gone very soon, and so if we add another rebate to Xcel customers only, then there's a lot of people who have no incentive to help them. So I prefer to see one that's more statewide, and I would also prefer to perhaps have a small bonus for using a Minnesota manufactured product, but not require us to use a Minnesota manufactured product, because there are other things involved. For example, the 10K solar product requires a very non-standard inverter to be used, and there are only a couple of choices of where to get those inverters, and they're also very small manufacturers. And so there are dominoes that happen when you identify a certain product, and then, for example, proprietary racking has to be used or a proprietary inverter. And if I can't get that, it stalls the whole process, and I can't install solar. And so those are just my suggestions. We're very encouraged by the program, and the goal to help promote solar locally is something, of course, that we would like to contribute to. We would just like to ask that you consider as few rules as possible when you're looking at a state program.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lundberg, for your testimony. That's helpful information. Senator Paraso.
Chair, I suggest that we start that legislators in many, many states and people in institutions that are doing research start considering reclamation as part of the picture instead of being fatalistic about it.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Lundberg. Appreciate your testimony today. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on this bill? Come on up, please. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Dan Williams. I'm also a solar installer, and I actually got into the business 4 years ago to install solar because it fit very well with my philosophical. I didn't know I was going to be involved in so many trips to the state capitol to get a new industry up and running. And a couple of comments. On considering solar as a risky venture, I totally disagree with that from the standpoint that produces clean energy up front, and we wouldn't have to be dealing with that bill we just heard about trucking away coal tar. So there's a subsidy. How long we're going to store the waste produced by other energies, there's a subsidy. Those are being passed on to our children, and we're actually paying for it that were passed on by our parents. Here's another fact. So those industries stay in the game. You're creating a new industry. You're going to employ more people. The supply chain on solar isn't just a silicon cell, a monocrystalline, polycrystalline, amorphous silicate, SIGs, or pick four more new technologies coming on. It's the racking that goes in. It's the flashing that was just developed 3 years ago by several different manufacturers that are selling tens of thousands of those products. That manufacturer didn't exist. They're employing people. The new innovations for building integrated products. So it's just another competing product out there that provides clean energy up front and lessens the unintended consequences that we never think about when we try to incentivize industry. Now, I agree with a couple of points and several points that were made in this bill. And I never thought getting into this that I would have to fight so hard for something I believed in, but here I am. I should actually be outside on the roof assessing or installing or engineering a system right now because it's a sunny day. But I'm not, from the standpoint that the last round with several of the unintended consequences of the language caused quite a bit of delay. We had to send home five or six of our employees, and they've been sitting for 5 months. Now multiply that by 10 or 20 installers that are smaller or larger in size, and you've got several hundred people that are already in the industry sitting home right now. So when we do create bills, and I'm not trying to do a tongue-lashing against anybody, but I just want to make sure we don't pick winners, we create innovation, and we don't create unintended bottlenecks in the industry. So the way the bill is written right now, several bottlenecks exist as I see it. One of them is language in 3B. And 3B states, must present evidence that applicant has applied for rebate or other financial form of assistance. So I'm assuming they mean applied for state rebate or the current Excel Solar Rewards program. Well, if the state rebate runs out, they can't apply for that. And if Excel Solar Rewards is competing for the same funds, we have a little conundrum. So those two issues, I think you should be concerned. I think that's also been the biggest issue with getting solar off the ground is that we have a stop and start with state rebates right now. If we did have a program that lasted 5 years and matched the federal tax incentive, we wouldn't be coming back to this table in 5 years. We'd be done. We wouldn't need any more incentives. As a matter of fact, if we could take the amount of cost it takes to haul coal tar away and add that to the electricity costs for coal-based electricity, I could compete. If we could take the cost that it takes to store waste products for thousands of years and add that into the cost of electricity, I could compete without any incentives. So those are things we need to think about. I also agree that we want to be careful. I think it would be well thought out if we could come up with a percentage-based installation when you're targeting funds. So that way, as the cost of solar comes down, so does the incentive so that we reach that grid parity or that neutral playing ground where we have competing technologies and a lot more people working. I agree with Mr. Glahn that a percentage is best. It's also a lot easier for the homeowner to understand. Just so you know, the cost of PV since I got into this business 4 years ago has already come down 25% to 30%. It was $11 to $12 a watt to install 4 years ago. It's down to the $8-$9 a watt now. It just varies because of the complexity of the install, the engineering that might be necessary to prove a structure or ground or however we're going to install it can happen. So I would love to be buying Mr. Carroll's panels. I'm a little afraid that if we do approve a bill like this, and let's say it goes into effect July 1st, that there are no panels to be had. There are none that are listed. They're not being manufactured. They can't keep up with demand. So there I am with my crew sitting, waiting for those panels to come online. Now, which installer is going to get those first? And are we going to have a fair playing field when it comes to distribution of those panels? So I believe in a rebate structure now until we have answered the questions on long-term costs that are associated with other forms of energy, and you can put them on a clean, on a even playing ground. I don't think it's going to be for long. I also believe that every dollar you spend on a state rebate spurs $3 to $4 of private investment. So I'm all for solar energy, and I'm all for these panels. I just think that we're presenting a bottleneck here. So those are some of my comments.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today. Other questions? All right. Thank you. Members, we really need to move on. We have several other complex bills. And let me just ask, is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on this bill? I'm thinking about, I know we have a short timeline, but I'm thinking about perhaps calling a short stakeholder meeting to sort of work through some of these issues and come up with something that everyone is happy with, ideally. But we have to do that very, very soon. We'd have to do that in the next couple of days. So we'll keep you all posted on that. So thank you. I think we can work these issues out. I really do. And I think Senator Tomasoni, you brought a really good proposal to us. So I hope we can find a way to make it work for everyone.
Well, Madam Chair, I do also want to point out that the bill was introduced on February 12th and was first heard on March 8th. And, you know, some of these, I realize some of the people aren't around the Capitol all the time. But, you know, some of the people that are around the Capitol all the time could have easily come and talked to us about this, and we might have had some of these things ironed out that are problems. But, you know, just to hear from somebody for the first time right here at the table and testifying after the bill's been around for 2 months is, you know, a little bit disingenuous. And I don't know why we would deal with hypotheticals or what a proposed bill has to do with eliminating jobs. I don't understand any of those comments. So anyway, I just wanted to put that out there, Madam Chair, and I really think you should lay it over and put it in your bill and then kind of deal with how to go about it after that.
Well, Senator Tomasoni, we've worked with a lot of the solar industry over the years, and they have a lot of experiences that we need to take into account.
And I agree.
They're small businesses, and they don't always – it would have been great if they could have been at the Energy Committee hearing, but maybe some of them weren't. You know, they don't have full-time lobbyists.
I wasn't them, complaining so. About them.
Okay.
Okay.
Good. I'm glad. Because we're all, I think, focused on the same goal here. And we want to make sure we end up with a goal that works, a plan that will work for everyone. All right. Someone move to lay the bill on the table for inclusion in our omnibus bill, and we will continue working on language as we move forward.
Madam Chair, I'll make that motion.
Senator Vickerman makes the motion that Senate File 2676 as amended. Any further discussion on the bill? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
I think, Senator Saxog, I think I'll do my bill real quick. Hopefully it should be quick. If you want to come on up. And then we'll do Chaudhry's.
Senator Anderson, Senate File 3275.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee member. Senate File 3275 is, I think, a very simple bill, and we introduced it in response to the legislative auditor's report. And I don't know if you have this language, probably not in front of you unless you have it in your folders, but one of the recommendations of the legislative auditor's recent report on natural resource land was that we really need a long-range budget analysis that compares the budget needs for DNR managed lands with the funding that's available. And that's really what we're asking for in this bill. And we did something similar to that on parks last year, and it was very helpful to have DNR come back with a look at what are the long-range needs in the budget for our park system. And we've heard a great deal of discussion about the management needs of our public lands because DNR owns a lot of them, and we are moving on a path of adding more to our inventory of lands in the future. So that's really what the bill is for, and I would like this to be our vehicle bill, by the way, for our omnibus bill members. So just wanted to point that out, that it is in the House as well. We'll just amend other bills onto this.
And Senator Anderson, I think that when we got the report from the Office of Legislative Auditor, the good news is that the DNR has started a program to be working on those easements. So they've got a little bit of a jump on this, but I think this is a great way to proceed.
Very good. And Mr. Chair, this asked the DNR to come back with this information and report by October of 2010, and hopefully that's enough time. We can see if they have any comments on it, but that would give us time to prepare for next legislative session if there's work that we need to do to follow up on this.
Are there any questions from the committee? Any testimonies that DNR want to comment on this?
All right.
Well, do you have a motion?
Sure, Senator Mr. Anderson? Chair. Oh, good. I was hoping this would be quick, and I think there's everyone's in support of the goal here. So I would move that Senate File 3275 be recommended to pass and laid on the table for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Senator Anderson moves that Senate File 3275 be moved and laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Very good.
So done.
Chair, would you like to have Senator Chaudhry start, which I think the last two bills he'll be presenting?
That'd be Senator
Chaudhry? Whichever he wants to start with.
We'll let you make the choice, Senator Chaudhry, as to which one you want to start with.
I'll start with 1657.
Chaudhry, Senate File 1657.
Thank you, Mr.
Proceed.
Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senate File 1657 is chief authored by Senator Mary Olson. Due to a family emergency, she was not able to be here today and asked me to, as one of the co-authors of the bill, to present it. I've also been working with Senator Olson on the bill and am familiar with its contents. It is the result of discussions we've had in this committee. I believe this committee has heard this a version of this bill in the last session, as well as in the policy committee, regarding efforts to improve on our natural resource management. The goal of the bill is to improve the way Minnesota delivers environmental conservation services and funding. The current environment and natural resource programs and regulations are spread throughout several agencies, departments and boards, not to mention local government units. DNR, PCA, Bowser, Ag, Health, Commerce, Transportation, not to mention our counties, watershed districts, cities, and townships. We've proposed this legislation because Minnesotans are frustrated with the level of overlap and redundancy they see in the state's natural resource departments. We've heard perennial complaints about the need for multiple permits from multiple agencies with overlapping jurisdictions, as just one example. But in short, Minnesotans want to know that their government is spending their tax dollars as judiciously as possible, especially when facing budget deficits. So what this bill does is establish an Environment and Natural Resources Organization Advisory Committee to advise the legislature and the governor on an organization for state agencies and local governments to administer environment and natural resource policies. It contains 18 members. It requires geographic balance. It includes representatives from cities, counties, soil and water districts, watershed districts. It requires the advisory committee to hold public meetings, and its duties are to recommend a structure to provide an efficient and effective organization for state agencies and local governments to administer environment and natural resource policies. The duties are spelled out in the bill. It looks to accomplish 10 things: a reduction in redundant administrative personnel, accountability to the public, consolidation of project permitting functions, professionalism in the provision of services, reduced political influence in the process, enhanced public participation, alignment of services, new technology, assistance to businesses, and a reduction in overall, particularly redundant personnel that are needed to be accomplished, especially through attrition. It establishes two task forces, one employee-driven, one intergovernmental driven, and requires a report to the legislature on its recommendations. It does not specify what any type of reorganization or improvement should look like, but it puts the decisions in the hands of citizen environmental experts, state and local government officials, representatives from soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, and a host of other non-governmental organizations. We hope to, with this bill in the end, to derive recommendations to do more with less, to eliminate duplicative services, to better utilize technology, to take a long-term comprehensive approach to protecting our environment. There is a list of various co-authors of the bill, including myself, and I think members have in their packet a variety of letters of support. And is Mr. Syme here? Okay. Mr. Syme was going to be here to testify. He had a medical condition that kept him from being here today. However, there is a PowerPoint presentation which he intended to present on some of his views on natural resource management and thoughts on restructuring. He is an aquatic biologist at the Beltrami Soil and Water Conservation District and is a professor at the Bemidji State University. And just a footnote, Mr. Syme is the source of many of our discussions we've had in this committee and in the policy committee regarding invasive species and protecting Minnesota waters. In fact, he came up with the notion of quote-unquote invasibility, it's not just about spreading invasive species, it's about the establishment of invasive species. So some of my pontifications that you hear on that come directly from Mr. Syme, for better or for worse. What would the Madam Chair, how would you like to proceed?
Well, Senator Chaudhry, let's see if there's questions or comments. Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Chaudhry, we're up to 30 people on the Organization Advisory Committee.
And I think the PowerPoint that I was reading off of needs to be updated.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily have any question that any of these groups should be on there, but I just came up with a couple that aren't on there. The Association Minnesota Counties, League of Minnesota Cities, Trails and Park Association, the Minnesota Mining Association, maybe MinUSA, and maybe some of the at least one from the MOHA or a group such as that. So. I don't want to spend a lot of, Madam Chair, I don't want to spend all day arguing about what ought to be in there. So I'm just wondering if there's some way we could make that decision be later. Maybe that not be a legislative decision right now.
Well, Senator Saxog, it's kind of now is the time to, I think this is probably the last committee this would go to until, except for full finance. So. I understand it's complicated trying to create that balance. There are some public members that are undesignated, so there are some opportunities to add more representation on the first page. Two public members appointed by the House, and then three appointed by the governor, and there must be two by the Senate. So that's, what, 4-7 other members that could meet some of those other issues, but if you want to add some other suggestions to Senator Chaudhry,
well, Madam Chair and Senator Chaudhry, at the very least, I think that because they're so involved in both the DNR and the MPCA, the mining group should be on there, if nothing more, for their general input. And I think the cities and the counties would be good additions also.
Madam Chair, Senator Saxon, they are included. If you look on page 2, starting on 2.21, the Senate appointments must include a representative of city government, the House representative's appointments must include a representative from county government, and the governor's appointment must include one representing soil and water conservation districts, one representing watershed districts, and one representing tribal governments. So all of the three governor's appointments actually do have specific locations where they're supposed to be from, and then one each for the Senate and House appointments are supposed to also do that. The other appointments are not, or the other people that would be on this are not appointed. They're selected by their organizations.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you for pointing that out, Mr. Knopf. So I guess that would leave for me. I don't certainly have anything against agriculture, but there's about 10 ag representatives on there, and just soon have somebody from mining and somebody from outdoor heritage and maybe somebody from trails and parks at the very least.
I think those are helpful suggestions. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Who makes these appointments?
Well, if you look on the first page,
this shall be appointed.
You mean of each of the organizations?
Right.
I think they select their person.
And then two members of the Senate. Is there members from the House?
Yes.
Yeah. If you look on the first page.
So then this would have to go to Rules Committee.
It will have to go to Rules Committee.
I just came from Rules Committee.
Yes, we were aware of that.
It was very interesting. Good luck.
Is that a warning?
Yeah. Good luck.
Interesting. That's what I was aware of that. That if it goes into our omnibus bill, we'll make a stop there on the way,
mm-hmm.
which is fine.
Well, Madam Chair, how about it? Rather than cutting anybody out of here, I just move to add three or four or whatever.
It's unfortunate Senator Olson isn't here just to get her opinion on it. I mean, I suppose what we could do, Senator Saxhog, would you consider waiting on the amendment till perhaps Friday when we mark up the bill?
Absolutely.
And then we could make sure Senator Olson will be here. Will she be around Friday? Do we know? We hope. Well, we'll give her a chance to at least be here to comment on that. So why don't we
Madam Chair, I'd like to speak with her about that. And with that, Senator Chaudhry, I'd move the bill.
Sure. That sounds good, Senator Saxhog. And if other folks have suggestions, we can incorporate those into amendments. On Friday, what we'll be doing is offering amendments to what we put on the table for people to consider. Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, come before my committee work with the senator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 30 members is a big operation. I really don't think we need that many, but that try to take care of everybody. You'll have members talking to members, and that. So, anything, I'd like to cut down to 30, but I won't because this took care of the rest of them. So,
is it possible to have sort of the general agricultural groups rather than every commodity? Well, I suppose you went through that in your committee. Then we might want to have, you know, the pine trees and the lakes associations. And, I mean, we do, if you start going down that road with natural resources, boy, I think Senator Saxhog has just touched the tip of that iceberg. Parks, trails, lakes, hunters, anglers, canoers, snowmobile. I mean, my God, I really, just now that I'm thinking about that, we'd probably have another 100 to add.
Madam Chair, I don't see bird watchers in any place.
You're right. You're right. That's not right. We have to. So we have this is going to be a challenge.
Madam Chair, it bears a little discussion, but, you know, I guess, though, if I finally got down to one that I think would be helpful to have on there would be representative of the mining community, since so much of what these organizations do would revolve around them, too.
And certainly a timely issue. So, all right. I think we should all ponder this and consult with Senator Chaudhry and Senator Olson over the next couple of days and come up with some ideas for Friday if we have some ways to improve upon the list. I think that's the time to make those final decisions, if that makes sense, if members are comfortable with that. Would anybody else like to be heard on Senate File 1657? Oh, come on up. Mr. Bone.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ray Bone. I'm here representing the All-Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota, as well as amateur riders of motorcycles. You know, between us and I know with the snowmobiles, we represent approximately 500,000 people out there that utilize those natural resources. And when I first saw the bill, I didn't, you know, frankly, I looked at the list and I didn't really give it much thought. But then as it's growing and growing, you know, you begin to wonder, well, you know, it seems to me there should be a place for us at the table so our concerns are heard directly. And And I guess I would encourage you, and I have not had a chance, I apologize to Senator Chaudhry, I have not had a chance to talk to him or Senator Olson. I did mention it briefly to Senator Olson the other day that we were getting concerned about the way this thing was shaping up. But anyway, I appreciate your willingness to take a look at that, and I think there should be a place for the recreational users as well at the table. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Bone. Ms. Erickson.
Madam Chair, members, Judy Erickson, Parks and Trails Council. And just to add to what Mr. Bone and Senator Saxhug said, that there is a component of outdoor recreation that will be affected by this action, and we want to make sure that our interests are also considered. We work, a lot of the discussion has revolved around the regulatory aspects of these agencies. Parks and Trails is recreation, and we want to make sure that the interests that we have are also considered. So as you move forward, we appreciate working with you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Welcome to the committee.
Senator, Chairman, my name is Craig Pagel with the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. We, too, would like to be considered in it. If you look at lands and minerals, in the lands that DNR oversees and what they do with the iron mines, I think it would really be important that we have some input and maybe get a better understanding of just what lands and minerals brings into the state. As an example, 2008, the six taconite mines brought in $165 million to the state and local governments in taxes and royalty. If we want to start looking at the return on investment to the state, you might want to include some of the biggest stakeholders. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair, is there a fiscal note on this bill?
There is. Mr. Mueller.
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, it's a multi-agency fiscal note that it's having some time to finance to put together. There will be some per diem costs and some administrative costs from especially some of the larger agencies that we'll have to deal with. And then hopefully the fiscal note's done today or tomorrow that I'll have a final bottom line number on.
Do you have a rough guesstimate?
It'll be a couple $100,000. Okay. One-time money. And, we'll have to discuss whether some of the various funds from some of those agencies can maybe be tapped for some one-time money for this, or if they can absorb some of the cost.
But if we have 100 members, it might get a little expensive. I think we're headed in that direction.
I think we better go down.
I'm looking around the room and thinking of more we haven't even mentioned. We haven't barely, just about every industry works with the Pollution Control Agency on permitting, and not just farmers, not just mines. But there's so many others, and I'm thinking of recycling and waste management, and it's kind of an endless list that could encompass half of Minnesota's economy or more. So this is going to be a real challenge to figure out, should we make it totally inclusive, and if so, incredibly unwieldy, or what are the alternatives? I mean, I think this is important. It's not an easy thing to figure out how to do it successfully, though. Senator Saxhug.
Well, Madam Chair, I kind of agree with you. I think we've developed a list here with the ones I had and the ones that are already in there of all the testifiers.
Yeah.
All of the people are going to have input, so they'll have input.
Yeah.
So we may
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
When you look, there's 11 public members. They could be anybody. Mm-hmm. Deer hunters, Mohawk, could be anybody.
True.
We didn't specifically say those.
Mm-hmm. Actually, only two.
Well, some of them are designated, but some of them are not.
We have two left.
Okay. Senator Chaudhry?
Thanks. My own view is that in working for the past 9 or 10 months on a variety of stakeholders, that this is such a huge issue to get one's arms around. That it's better to err on the side of inclusiveness, and figure out if the list gets large. And I've served on advisory committees, and I think that the list is large and could be larger. But I think if we really are serious about improving our natural resource management, then we have to err on the side of inclusiveness because so many stakeholders are affected by it. And that's a source of pride for me. It's a source of pride that we are involved in a topic area that affects so many Minnesotans in so many different ways. I think it's a challenge, but I think it's a source of pride as well that we get to work on this with all these different people on this topic. So, and I didn't have a problem with Senator Saxhog's suggestions at all in adding those. I mean, this has kind of been a rolling addition anyway. We added a few in ag, we added a few in state and local government, and you know, this has got a ways to go anyway. So I think as far as the process, as we move through the process and build momentum for doing this in general, I don't think we should let the number of people on the committee and involved get in the way of the ultimate goal. And probably the more people are involved, the better better ideas will come out of this process in the end anyway.
All right. Senator Chaudhry moves that Senate File 1657 be recommended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill and laid on the table. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Members, we do, we're not in session until 12:30, so I think we have time to finish the last bill, and then hopefully you'll have a few minutes to grab some lunch. Senator Chaudhry on Senate File 2916.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2916 is the DNR's environmental technical bill that contains the non-game and fish items for the department. With me to talk about it is Bob Meyer.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also have various staff with me today. In case there's questions, we can have them come up and answer. I'm just going to walk through the bill section by section, and then we can take questions as we go, if that works for everybody.
Very minimal. Please, that's
all right,
great.
Madam Chair, Section 1 deals with, you'll see several sections that deal with this. What we're trying to clarify is that we have the ability to collect professional services, fleet management services, and facility services from other governmental units, including tribal governments. This would be where we would have a clerical staff that would be doing some work, or there'd be some memorandum that we'd want to recapture our staffing costs. So this would allow us to do that. Section 2 deals with the clarification with our electronic licensing system from a bill that we had last session allowing us to sell gift cards. We want to expand the ELS system to allow us to sell gift cards. And you can see we're striking the word duplicate there on line 2.1 or 2.6. Currently, we're restricted to only selling duplicate firearm safety cards. We want to use our new system to issue duplicate and original firearm safety cards. So you can see that it's actually safety training certificates. So it's going to be your snowmobile, your ATV, your firearm safety card, bow hunter card, things of that nature. You can, as we're restricted to just duplicates previously, we're allowing it to be issuing duplicates and original certificates as well. Currently, when you take the test and complete the training, you get a piece of paper that is your temporary card. The instructor then sends the information in, and then they get the cards back and the patches most times, and then they send those out to the members. This is just a way to streamline that entire system. So we're looking to do that in that section. Section 3 and 4 are similar to Section 1, where we're looking to actually capture the costs to other governmental units, including tribal governments, for our fleet management if we rent a piece of equipment to local government units, such as one of our pieces of heavy equipment, things of that nature, to do some work. We want to make sure we can capture those costs. And Section 4, facilities management, this will allow us to bill organizational units outside of the DNR for rental of some of our facilities that are out there, if they're using those for a large meeting or some ongoing purpose, to capture those costs and deposit them in that account. Section 5, Madam Chair, you'll see we're dealing with snowmobile registrations. And what we're doing here is creating a one-time lifetime registration for snowmobiles that are over 25 years old. Currently, if you have a collector snowmobile, you can use that similar to a collector car, but only, I believe, about 10 events per year is the restriction right now. This would allow a person, if you have one of those collector snowmobiles, to pay a one-time $6 registration fee, and then with a trail sticker, you could ride it all season long. So right now, you're prohibited. You either have to pay the full registration, or if you do not need to be registered if you're over 25 years old, but then you're limited to that 10 rides per year. This allows that person to be able to ride in the entire season for this lifetime registration. It's good for the lifetime. It's not transferable to owners, but it's good for the lifetime that you would own that machine. You can see the language that I'm talking about. There's actually in Section 6, snowmobiles may be issued an exempt registration if the machine is at least 25 years old and it's valid from the date of issuance until that ownership is transferred. Section 7 and Section 8 are two changes that came in the policy committee, changing the weight of a Class 1 all-terrain vehicle from 900 to 1,000 pounds, and Section 8 dealing with that weight change from a Class 2 900 to 1,000 and then 1,500 to 1,800 pounds. Section 9 is similar to what we talked about with snowmobiles in Section 5 and 6, but it allows an all-terrain vehicle to be issued a collector limited use registration, it's called. And then Section 10 is that same language that we talked about. It's a one-time registration fee for $6. This allows that permanent, that 25-year-old machine user to be able to have it registered. The concern we had with this was that these machines don't have to be registered, but the people who were out riding on a trail system kept getting stopped by our conservation officers because they didn't have any registration or numbers on the machine. And then they would have to say, well, it's 25 years old, and we recognize that they're exempt. So this is actually brought to us by some users who said, can you just give me a one-time registration to avoid that? And it actually helps with our enforcement activities as well, so we know who those people are that are out there.
So, Mr. Meyer, how many of those old vehicles are around, do you think?
Do you have an estimate? Snowmobiles or ATVs?
There's maybe several hundred in each class, but it's going to keep going. I mean, some ATVs are only used during the hunting season, for example, so those can last. People will use them and they're in relatively good shape. They could have several thousand miles only on them and they're 25 years old. So it's a way for us to make sure that they're registered in the system and give them some flexibility and identification. Section 11 deals with our safety training programs. You'll see the changes are on 5.31 and 5.32. Currently, and this is our all-terrain safety programs, currently when you go to a firearms class or a bow hunting education class, there's a base fee. And then the instructor is allowed to charge up to that amount of the base fee for materials. A lot of times people provide sodas and hot dogs and things like that. That's covered under that base fee. We didn't have that language, or we currently don't have that language in the all-terrain safety class. So what we're doing is clarifying that each person may only charge up to the established fee amount for class materials and expenses. So in this case, it's $15. They can only charge an additional $15. We're trying to close a loophole there that was brought to our attention, Madam Chair. Section 12 of the bill deals with all-terrain vehicle trail grant and aid programs. You can see the language that we're changing will allow a grant and aid trail system to be established in part of the road right-of-way if the road authority and the DNR approve of that location. So there's a seven-step process we go through in establishment of a grant and aid trail, which includes a review of our ecological services staff, our fish and wildlife staff, parks and trail staff, working with that grant and aid club and the local unit of government to make sure that that road or that trail should be there. This was brought to our attention where there's some trails that need some connectors through a ditch corridor to make a grant and aid system safer to provide connectivity. We proceeded with this language that we have here to help deal with that. Section 13 of the bill, Madam Chair, is a provision that we pursued last session, and actually it was changed somewhat in the Senate Policy Committee. Currently, there's a segment of the trail connections, the Arrowhead Regional Trails. It was called the Minnesota-Wisconsin Boundary Trail, and it was part of the Willard-Munger Trail System you'll see in Section 14. The changes that occurred in the Policy Division named this segment of the trail the Becky Laurie Trail. This is a snowmobile ATV trail. It runs from Duluth to the St. Croix Forest. And then what we were trying to correct, and I'm not sure if this language works anymore or not, because we were trying to clarify, because that trail segment is now part of the Arrowhead Trail System, and we were removing it from the Willard Munger Trail System. There's a confusion. What we're trying to clarify is the motorized versus the non-motorized segments of this trail system that's there. Currently, if you look in Section 14, the struck-out language was the Boundary Trail, which originated in Saugo County and extended into Duluth and St. Louis County. That is a motorized snowmobile ATV trail. There were people who were going to the Willard Munger Trail to bike. They thought that this was a segment of that, and then they see ATVs on there. And likewise, we had people doing the opposite, going to the Willard Munger Trail, trying to take a motorized machine there. So we're trying to avoid the confusion there. And then the change up in Section 4, Section 13, I should say, to that segment name occurred in the Senate Environment Policy Committee.
Madam Chair, I just want to let you know that this was my amendment. It was not an amendment to be glib in any way. I'm very serious about this change, and I intend for it to pass.
Which one is that?
To name the trail the Becky Laurie Trail.
Oh, that was your idea. I think it's great.
Madam Chair, Section 15, clarifying the deposit of fees. Currently, when we have a timber blowdown, this was brought to us from an issue that occurred in St. Croix State Forest or St. Croix State Park. We had a major timber blowdown, and when we went to salvage those trees, the revenues were deposited into the general fund, and we needed to capture those revenues to do the reforestation and reestablishment work within that state forest. So what we're doing is clarifying that gross receipts from sales, rentals, or leases of natural resources within state parks, rec areas, and waysides, other than those on trust fund lands, must be deposited in the state park's working capital account. And the Section 16 works in conjunction with this, just saying that purchases for resale or rental made from state parks are exempt from competitive bidding, because when we're reselling those products, we would have to go through a competitive bidding process. We're just clarifying that they're exempt from that process. Section 17 is a technical correction to our canoe and boating routes. In conjunction with looking at our increased marketing activities and what other states are doing, it became rather confusing when we have state trails, snowmobile trails, biking trails, whatever kind of trail. Then when it comes to these canoe and boating trails, they were called canoe and boating routes. So what we're doing is calling these water trails now. So all of our canoe and boating routes will be called water trails, kind of a creative marketing tool, working with Explore Minnesota, talk about our trail systems, water trails that we have. We're also adding the Blue Earth River into that trail system. Section 18 talks about the deposits of receipts. This is works in conjunction with Senator Saxog's cross-country ski fee increase somewhat. What we're trying to clarify is that the cross-country ski monies that are there, just clarifying where that they can be used for the following purposes: grant and aid cross-country ski trails to counties and municipalities for construction and maintenance of cross-country ski trails, special park districts as provided in Section 85.44 for construction and maintenance, and develop and maintenance of cross-state cross-country ski trails. And actually, I think we need to amend this language somewhat. We've been working on this in the House. There's the issue with this fund. We have about 50% of the cross-country ski trails are located within state parks. However, we do not have the ability to access any of those funds from the snowmobile sticker or the cross-country ski sticker in the state park system. So what we've amended in the House bill would allow the development and maintenance of cross-country ski trails to be eligible by legislative appropriation. This is an open appropriation that we receive from the cross-country ski permit. So I don't think it is probably correct to have an open appropriation and allow that to have the department to appropriate money to itself. So we would like to clarify that section, Madam Chair. Section 19, what we found with the horse trail pass since inception is several, it's been brought to our attention from the Horse Council and others that people have been getting around the use of a horse trail pass by riding not on the horse trail system but adjacent to or sometimes cross-country travel within the state forest, thereby negating the need to have a horse trail pass. So the changes in this section really are amending the horse trail pass to be a Horse Pass. You can see we're striking the requirements to have it on horse trails associated with day use areas on state trails, parks, and rec areas, and having the requirement to be on lands administered by the commissioner. So the rest of those changes in this section, section 19 through lines 11.33 deal with that change that's there. Section 20 of the bill exempts from the master planning process in the Outdoor Recreation Act scientific and natural areas. 86A.09 subdivision 1 talks about the need for a master plan that is required. We spoke about this in a little bit with the Lake Vermilion State Park issue, that no construction of new facilities other than development of an authorized unit can commence until the managing agency has prepared and submitted to the Commissioner of Natural Resources a master plan. And the scientific and natural area is similar to a wildlife management area, an aquatic management area. There is no development that occurs. There are no buildings that are built on an SNA. There's no trails that go into a scientific and natural area. So we feel that this exemption is justifiable for these units. Section 21 of the bill clarifies when there is beaver damage. If a beaver dam is constructed on your neighbor's property, currently there's a process you have to go through that would require the commissioner, the DNR, the adjacent landowner, the current landowner, and the county board to all come to agreement before that dam could be removed. Some people like to have beaver dams on their property and don't want to remove it. So, but those dams will back up water and cause damage to the adjacent property owner. What this provision would allow would that private property owner would be able to go directly to the petition to the district court. You can see there the court may order the owners of private property where beaver dams are located to take action to reduce the threat. Then a permit would not be required for an action of the court. The action may include destruction or alteration of the dam, removal of the beaver, and then it does not apply to state parks, game refuges, and federal game refuges. Section 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, and 27 are technical waters issues. And actually, I think I'll have Jim Japs from the Division of Waters come up and walk through those sections, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Japs, Assistant Director, Division of Waters. Section 22 eliminates a reference to 103G295, which is repealed by this bill, in Section 37. Section 23 eliminates the requirement for public water inventory lists because it's now easier to modify, update, and provide maps electronically than it was.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just need you to introduce yourself, and I'm sorry if you did.
Okay. Jim Japs, DNR Waters Assistant Director.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Section 23 eliminates the requirement for public water inventory lists. It's now easier to modify, update, and provide maps electronically than it was when the inventory was completed in the early 1980s. Section 24 eliminates a reference in 103G295, which is eliminated by the bill. Section 25 relates to monitoring to evaluate impacts from appropriations. This is similar to a section 103G281, which requires monitoring of water withdrawals. It also provides for the apportionment of costs amongst users of a common resource in order to reduce the costs for individual permittees. Section 26 is a technical change related to trout streams. Section 27 addresses groundwater appropriation issues, and it replaces an obsolete section that only applied to agricultural appropriations. That's the section that's being repealed, 103G295. Section 28 relates to providing proof of service on our applications, which is no longer needed because the permit documents are primarily provided electronically to reviewers. Section 29 and 30 eliminate the reference to 103G295, which again is repealed by this bill. Section 31 clarifies that when a dam is removed, and it's the lowest cost solution, that the commissioner may pay the entire cost for the dam removal. And then Section 32 clarifies in statute that the removal of sunken logs from public waters is prohibited. Laws of 2000 established a system for permitting the removal of logs, but then in 2001, there was a session law that actually prohibited the removal of logs, so this would just clarify that that is prohibited.
Madam Chair, Section 33 was an issue that I know, I think you offered the amendment actually in the policy committee to clarify. We did come to an agreement. This deals with the non-game wildlife checkoff and the LCCMR approval authority. What the language that we're striking is in 18.16, 18.17, that would require that previously none of the money could be expended until the commission has approved the work program. These funds are legislatively appropriated. We still will be presenting to the LCCMR the work program. It just will allow us to be able to spend the money, and the commission will not have the ability to approve the spending of those legislatively appropriated dollars. There's a change in 18.7 as well that just clarifies it. It said that the non-game program within the section of wildlife, the non-game program is actually within the department and the Ecological Resources Division now, so we're just clarifying that. Lines 18.23 to 18.30 will allow us to use funds from the non-game wildlife fund for the purpose of developing, preserving, restoring, and maintaining wintering habitat for neotropical migrant birds in Latin America and the Caribbean under agreement or contract with nonprofit organizations. You can see also it says on 18.28, under this authority, the commissioner may execute agreements and contracts if the commissioner determines that the use of these funds will benefit neotropical migrant birds that breed or migrate throughout the state. Many of our birds that we see here in the summertime like to winter in warmer areas like a lot of other people do. And this will allow us to provide work with some other neighboring states and associations that our members and department belong to provide habitat. There's a similar provision within the duck stamp dollars that we provide money to Delta waterfowl in Canada to protect nesting habitat, wetlands, the Delta marsh area in Canada. We do have an agreement with the Delta Waterfowl Association to do that. This would be done with the same way, with the same requirements that are out there for granting and oversight through the Department of Administration. And this is currently done. Other states are doing this. Other departments of conservation are doing this. And we feel it's an appropriate use of the funds.
What's the difference between a tropical bird and a neotropical bird?
Bird specialists are out doing other work right now. Neotropical birds are birds such as warblers, thrushes, things like that, that we see around here all the time. So we can definitely get you that answer. Section 34 of the bill, you can see it's just dealing with the corporate non-game wildlife fund as well, Madam Chair, making that same change with the LCCMR work program that we had worked out with the commission. Section 35, I just mentioned to the author that can be removed from this bill. This language is already passed within the bonding bill, is assigned into law. Section 36 is just the revisor's instructions dealing with the horse trail pass, the canoe and boating routes, and also C, 19.31, the Conservation Corps they had an amendment in the policy committee to change their name to the Conservation Corps Minnesota rather than Minnesota Conservation Corps. And then you can see the repealers that are listed and attached in Section 37.
Mr. Meyer, what do you do with the beavers when they're removed?
They usually aren't relocated, Madam Chair.
They're not. There's usually a little collateral damage in the process.
Typically, a trapper will come in. Most of these are trapped. The nuisance beavers are trapped in the early spring if they can, but then these issues will rise year-round, so they will either be trapped. One of the preferred methods is to try to go in there and use what is called the Clemson Beaver Dam Leveler. It's basically a PVC tube with screen on it and holes drilled into it that will allow the beaver dam to stay in place but water to move through that structure.
A beaver never knows.
So hopefully some people may not want to do that, though, as well. So what we're trying to do is is bring people to mutual agreement. You can see it on those repealers, on the first page of the repealers, the rather cumbersome process there in 97B.665. The county board has to unanimously consent. Landowner approves, commissioner agrees, and the act is financially feasible. So we're trying to just provide a little bit more flexibility in these issues where the courts can maybe provide a little bit more of a balanced judgment, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, in general, they're made into hats and gloves. Very nice ones, too.
I just keep being reminded of the Utah visitors who talked about removing all those prairie dogs and kind of relocating them in a new place. And I thought, we don't do things like that in Minnesota, do we? I can't think of any examples where we take wildlife and, except in zoos.
That's, Chair.
Senator Frederickson.
About 25 years ago, we tried to relocate an elk herd.
Yeah.
And what happened?
It was a disaster.
It was a disaster.
It was
not
well.
Successful. Turns out the elk did not want to be moved.
That's probably pretty typical. Senator Saxhog.
And Madam Chair, the beaver in Minnesota has been almost solely responsible for increasing our pre-settlement wetlands. There's more wetlands now than there was before because of the beaver.
That's interesting. I don't know if everyone agrees on your there's more than there used to be. That
no,
I,
it's one
of
the
debate,
reasons that wetlands have increased.
Have increased, certainly.
In northeastern Minnesota.
Sure, that makes
northern.
Sense. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to direct a question to Mr. Japs.
Mr. Japs? Go ahead, please.
In Section 27, groundwater appropriations, Mr. Jeffs, would you give us a little more explanation about how this provision interfaces with the groundwater metropolitan, recalling it? We just passed the bill yesterday out of
the monitoring program.
The monitoring program. How does this work interface with that work?
Mr. Jeffs. This is relating to permitting requirements, I think. So,
right. This, Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, this section actually replaces, it's a section that's specific to groundwater appropriations. We currently have a section that's specific to surface water appropriations, and the part that we're repealing in this bill, 103G295, was adopted back in the late 70s when we had a big irrigation boom. And so, we had a lot of groundwater provisions, but they just applied to agricultural irrigation. And what we want to do with this section of the bill is open that up so that it's generic to all groundwater users, not just agricultural users.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Saxhog.
Madam Chair, I would move that Section 35 be removed per the recommendation of Commissioner Meyer.
And that's Lake Vermilion. It's
that's
already
Lake
been signed
Vermilion's
into law.
Paper.
So on the motion, any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Senator Shetry, any other comments? I think we'll put this in the omnibus bill if that works for you. I think that's what we normally do.
It's usually a put policy in it.
Well, we're going to have policy in this bill. This definitely has a lot of policy in it. We'll probably put the lands bill in, too.
Yeah.
Because it has, this doesn't have significant physical impact.
So maybe we could travel both. We could spill in, travel on its own.
Mr. Knopf?
Well, Madam Chair, you did have the issue that Mr. Meyer mentioned with the cross-country ski account and the statutory appropriation that's in this bill for state trails and the concern that people have over that. So that would be an issue that you would probably want to pass on without getting that resolved.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think we need some language on the appropriation. We could, Senator Shadri, do you have strong feelings about taking this to the floor?
I'd like to. I think it's traveling on its own in the House, and I'd like to like the companion to move forward as well. I have no problem with it being in this bill as well, or if there's a finance issue with the passes, taking that part out and having it in your bill, that's fine too.
I think that's what we would want to do. If we let it go separately, we should just take out those sections and leave them here. So, Mr. Knopf, you want to identify the ones
well,
that...
Well, Madam Chair, you have...
separate them?
On page 9, section 18, on the disposition of receipts. Well, actually, if you look up section 17 also, we have a separate bill on that. In fact, the names of... Actually, the DNR recommended an amendment to that bill that's different from this, because in there it's just they're called water trails, not water trail routes. Mm-hmm. And there was also a $60,000 appropriation that was attached to it, too, to pay for.
Which bill is that
river.
In?
Senator Rosen's bill. I think it's...
Oh. Did we already hear that?
Yes.
I think so.
I guess I missed that, yeah. Okay, so,
and so
maybe we should
you may want to take that one out
to try
too.
To reconcile it.
Yeah, and then you'd also in the revisor's instructions take it out of there also. So section 17, section 18, and then in the revisor instruction on page 19, I think you'd want to delete paragraph B.
And then if we just delete that, we could
put that in your omnibus bill along with the rest of this bill if you want to have it in both places.
I don't know if we need the whole bill here. I want to take the things out. Well, staff had recommended. I guess that's our practice normally is to keep it. So what we should do then is take out these sections, send it on, and then keep the whole bill. Maybe we should just do that for simplicity's sake.
You know, Madam Chair, there are a number of things that are related to appropriations in here. Mm-hmm. I mean, the non-game wildlife, a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily appropriations, but they are related to the jurisdiction of this division.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, Madam Chair, would I move then to take out sections 17, 18, and then sub-B of section 36?
Yes.
Correct. Anything, and that should cover it? All right. On that motion, Senator Chaudhry, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Then Senator Chaudhry moves. Well, we'll just have the language and we'll put it in our omnibus bill, members, so we don't have to vote on that.
Right.
Or at least the sections that we need. Senator Chaudhry moves that Senate File 2916, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full Finance Committee. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Madam Chair, didn't we just take the finance parts out?
We did.
Still
has to go to the Finance Committee because we're a subdivision of that. That's your next stop.
It's true. Okay. Thank you.
We took that out, didn't we? 17 and 18?
Yes.
Took out the cross country. Okay. That would be Section 18 that related to that. Mm-hmm. All right. On the motion, if there's no further discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, members, thank you. We'll see you at 10 a.m. tomorrow in room 123. The meeting's adjourned. 123.